Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Scotland, Episode 5, Post-Roman Era and the Saxon Arrival. Now, last episode, we said goodbye to our Roman Empire. They left Britain in a hurry, they struggled to hold onto their land, and the West Empire eventually fell. Obviously, the Eastern Roman Empire would survive on, and be later known as the Byzantine Empire, and would survive up until about the 1500s, until the Ottomans would wipe the floor with them. And the Greeks would begin hating all Turkish relations there. At the moment, in England, it is like 30 degrees, and I am dying whilst recording this podcast in terms of the heat. So I hope you all appreciate what the lengths I'm going to record this. Also, sorry for the delay in the episode as well. I know it's been a few days after the week I normally release it on, but I've just had a few things I've had to get doing on work. But it doesn't matter, we are back and we're ready to get stuck in. So in this episode, we're going to be touching on the Anglo-Saxon invasion and then the post-Roman Scotland, Britain, really. And I think next episode we'll begin touching on the Saxon relationships and the Viking relationships with Scotland. But with this episode, it's more of an overview on the Anglo-Saxon invasion and then where we are in Scotland, what's happened since the Romans have left. And you know, starting this podcast, I've come to appreciate the Scottish resilience against the Roman Empire. I mean, all of Britain fell apart from Scotland, and it's a testament to the tribal leadership that was formed up there from the Caledonians to the Picts, etc. So, yeah. Anyway, let's jump straight into this. Talking about the Anglo-Saxons, Anglo-Saxon mercenaries had for many years fought in the Roman army in Britain, so they were not total strangers to the island. Typical Romans using their own people to mercenaries to fight their wars, and then those mercenaries end up backstabbing them. The invasions were slow and piecemeal and began even before the Romans' legions departed. There is even some evidence to suggest that initially some Saxons were invited to help protect the country from invasion, again with the mercenary aspect. When the Roman legions left Britain, the Germanic-speaking Angles, Saxons, Jutes and Frisians began to arrive, at first in small invading parties, but soon in increasing numbers. Initially, they met little firm resistance from the relatively defenceless inhabitants of Britannia. Around 500 AD, however, the invaders were resisted fiercely by the Romano-British, who might have been led by King Arthur himself and the Round Table, if he existed. And there's no hard evidence that he did. And it is just folklore and a fairy tale, but it's a good folklore and fairy tale, and that one that is intertwined with English history. Many English kings would evoke King Arthur and the Round Table and his knights, and obviously the Garter, the Order of the Garter, that is still surviving in England to this day, did form from the King Arthur idea with King, I think it was King Edward the Second or Third. It's one with, I think, the Black Prince. Excuse my history on that. Anyway, however, the monk Gildas, writing in the mid-6th century, talks about a British Christian leader called Ambrosius, who rallied the Romano-British against the invaders and won 12 battles. Later accounts call this leader Arthur, see Saxon Settler Lesson Plan. The Celtic areas of Britain regarded the Saxons as enemies and foreigners on their borders. Their name became Sassanese to the Scottish and Sassic to the Welsh. Probably butchering those two names and pronunciations. Do apologise. The various Anglo-Saxon groups settled in different areas of the country. They formed several kingdoms, often changing and constantly at war with one another. These kingdoms sometimes acknowledged one of their rulers as a high king. By 1650 AD, there were several separate kingdoms as follows. Anglo-Saxon kingdoms 650 AD to 100 AD around 800 AD around, sorry. Kent, settled by the Jutes. Egbert of Kent was the first Anglo-Saxon king to be converted to Christianity by St. Augustine around 595 AD. Mercia, whose best known ruler Offa, built Offa's dyke along the border between Wales and England. This large kingdom stretched over the Midlands. Northumbria, where the monk Bede lived and wrote his History of Britain, the person who we've actually used as a source throughout our earlier episodes about the Pictish tribes, Caledonians and the Roman invasion. East Anglia, made up of Angles, the Norfolk living in modern Norfolk and the Southfolk living in Suffolk, the Sutton whose ship burial was found in East Anglia. Essex, here the famous Battle of Maldon was fought against the Vikings in 991 AD. Sussex, the South Saxons settled there. And finally, the Great Wessex, the West Saxons, later the Kingdom of King Alfred, the only English king to ever have been called the Great, and his equally impressive grandson Æthelstan I, who could truly call himself King of the English King of England, The Last Kingdom. Now, a bit of a side topic. A couple of TV shows, if you haven't already started watching them, which are pretty good to watch. Less historically accurate, but still fun. Around this time, you've got Vikings, which is probably the more known one, but the lesser known one is The Last Kingdom, and The Last Kingdom tells the story of the Last Kingdom, which was Wessex in the Viking invasion, and follows a folklore-ish character known as Uhtred, and I honestly would recommend watching those two series to give you an idea of this time. Alright. By 850 AD, the Seven Kingdoms had been consolidated into three large Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, Northumbria, Mercia and Wessex. The Anglo-Saxons had become a Christian people. So that's kind of the idea of what happened with the Saxons and their invasion. And now we're going to be getting into how they intertwined eventually with the Scottish people and the Scottish tribes. But I think we need to quickly touch on what's happening in Scotland right now. The Romans have left, Hadrian's Wall has been conquered, and Tony's Wall has been conquered. Where are we at? By the time of Bede, the monk who we did mention, in the late 7th century and the early 8th century, four major circles of influence had emerged in northern Britain. In the east, as mentioned in the previous episode, were the Picts, whose kingdoms eventually stretched from the River Forth to Shetland. In the west were the Gaelic-speaking people of Delrota, with their royal fortress at Dunat in Argyll. Remember, we did mention them, as well as allying with the Picts, with close links with the island of Ireland, from which they brought with them the name the Scots. And again, Delrota and the Picts would eventually form the Kingdom of Alba, and then eventually the Kingdom of Scotland. Originally a term for the inhabitants of Ireland was the Scots. Obviously that name was brought across. In the south was the British Kingdom of Alt Cult, descendants of the people of the Roman-influenced kingdoms of the Old North. Finally, there were the English or the Angles, Germanic invaders who had overrun much of southern Britain and held the Kingdom of Bernicia, later the northern part of Northumbria in the southeast, and who brought with them the Old English. Alright, the so-called Daniel Stone, Pictish cross slab fragment found in Easter Ross, the confederation of the Pictish tribes that developed north of the Forth may have stretched as far as Orkney. It probably developed out the tribes of the Caledoni, whose names continue to be used as at least part of the confederation, perhaps as a response, as we mentioned in the previous episode, to the pressure exerted by the presence of the Roman Empire to the south. They first appear in Roman records in the end of the 3rd century as Picti, when Roman forces campaign against them. The first identical king of the Picts, who seemed to have exerted a superior and wide-ranging authority, was Brydlan MacLean. His power was based in the kingdom of Fideac, and his base was at the fort of Craigpadrick, near the modern day of Inverness. After his death, leadership seems to have shifted to Fotheru, whose lands were centred on Moray and east of Ross, and who raided along the eastern coast into modern Britain. Christian missionaries from Anna appear to have begun conversion of the Picts into Christianity, and again we talked about that in the second episode. In the 7th century, the Picts acquired the Brynian map as a king, perhaps imposed by the Kingdom of Alcult, where his father, Bel I, and his brother, Ingo I, ruled. At the point, the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of Bernicia was expanding northwards, and the Picts were probably tributary to them in 1685 AD. The king defeated them at the Battle of Dunchin in Angus, killing their king, Egrif. In the region around there, the Picts appeared to have reached the height of their influence, defeating the forces of Delrota, and probably making them a tributary, invading Alcult and Northumbria and making the first known peace treaties with the English. Succeeding Pictish kings may have been able to dominate Delrota, perhaps placing his son Dom Nell on the throne from 811 AD, and that's when we'll start getting to the Kingdom of Alba. Delrota, the kingdom, the Gaelic kingdom of Delrota, was on the western coast of modern Scotland, with some territory on the northern coast of Ireland. It probably ruled from the fortress of Dunat, now near Cung Agrill and Boot. In late 6th and early 7th centuries, it encompassed roughly what is now Angrill and Boot and Lothabar in Scotland, and also County Antrim in Ireland. The Ritter is commonly viewed as having been an Irish Gaelic colony in Scotland, although some archaeologists have recently argued against this. The inhabitants of Del Ritter are often referred to as Scots, from Latin Scoti, a name used by Latin writers for the inhabitants of Ireland. It's originally meaning it's uncertain, but it later refers to the Gaelic speakers, whether from Ireland or elsewhere. And again, as we talked about, the Irish did kind of colonise around the eastern part and western part of Scotland, and this is where we have a lot of the similar cultures, history, etc. between the two nations. In 563 AD, a mission from Ireland under St. Columba founded the monastery of Iona off the west coast of Scotland and probably began the conversion of the region to Christianity. The kingdom reached its height under a king between the 574 and 608 AD, but its expansion was checked at the Battle of Daghestan in 603 AD by the King of Northumbria. Serious defeats in Ireland and Scotland in the time of 642 AD ended Del Ritter's golden age, as you will, and the kingdom became a client of Northumbria, similar to how the Pictish kingdom would become a client of Northumbria for some time, then a subject to the Picts. There is disagreement over the fate of the kingdom from the late 8th century onwards. Some scholars argued Del Ritter underwent a revival under a king in the 736 to 778 AD before the arrival of the Vikings. Now we're going to be getting on to the kingdom of Alt Cut and the kingdom of Strathclyde. Looking north at the Dumbarton Rock, the chief fort of Strathclyde from the 6th century to the 870 AD when it was taken by the Vikings. Alt Cut, after the Brynonic name from the Dumbarton Rock, the medieval capital of Strathclyde Kingdom, may have had its origins from the Damnoni people of Ptolemy's Geographia. Two kings are known from the near contemporary sources in this early period. The first is a king called Coritus, known as a recipient of a letter from St. Patrick, and stated by the 7th century biographer to have been a king of the height of the Clyde, Dumbarton Rock, placing him in the second half of the 5th century. From Patrick's letter, it is clear he was Christian, and it's likely that the ruling class of the area were also Christians, at least in their name. His descendant is named Adominus Life of St. Columba. After 600 AD, information on the Britons of Alt Cut becomes more common in sources. In 642, led by their son, they defeated the men of Del Ritter and conquered Domnall Grandson's kingdom as well. The kingdom suffered a number of attacks from the Picts as well, and later the Picts' Northumbrian allies between 744 AD and 756 AD. They lost the region of Kyle in the south-west of modern Scotland to Northumbria, and the last attack may have forced the king to submit to his neighbours. After this, little has been heard of the Alt Cut or its kings until the Alt Cut was burnt and probably destroyed in 780, although by whom and what circumstances is not known. Historians have traditionally identified Alt Cut with the later Kingdom of Strathclyde, but J.E. Fraser points to the fact there is no contemporary evidence that the heartland of Alt Cut was in Glenside, and the Kingdom of Strathclyde may have arisen from Alt Cut's decline. So before we kind of jump in to the relationships of the Pictish tribe that would later become the Kingdom of Alba, relationship with the Saxons and later the Vikings and all that, I think it's time to set the scene of also the geography of Scotland in the Middle Ages around this time. So, modern Scotland is half the size of England and Wales in area, but with its many inlets, islands and inland lochs, it is roughly the same amount of coastline at 4,000 miles. Only a fifth of Scotland is less than 60 metres above sea level. Its East Atlantic position means it is very heavy rainfall. Today, about 700 centimetres per year in the east and over 100,000 centimetres in the west. This encouraged the spread of blanket peat bog, the acidity of which combined with high level winds and salt spray made most of the islands treeless. The existence of hills, mountains, quicksands and marshes made internal communication and conquest extremely difficult and may have contributed to the fragmented nature of political power. The early Middle Ages was a period of climate deterioration with a drop in temperature and an increase in rainfall, resulting in more land becoming unproductive. Roman influence beyond Hadrian's Wall does not appear to have had a major impact on the settlement patterns, with Iron Age hill forts and forts continuing to be occupied through the early Middle Age period. These often had defences of dry stone or timber, lace walls, sometimes with a palisade. The large numbers of these forts have been taken to suggest monarchs and moving around their domains to control and administer them. In the Northern and Western Isles, the sites of Iron Age procs and wheelhouses continue to be occupied, but were gradually replaced with the less imposing cellular houses. There are a handful of major timber halls in the south comparable to those excavated in Anglo-Saxon England and dated back to around the 7th century. In areas of Scandinavian settlement in the islands along the coast, a lack of timber meant that the native materials had to be adopted for house building, often combining layers of stone with turf. Bit of grand designs on the go here. Place name evidence, particularly the use of the prefix Pict, meaning land or a field, suggests the heaviest areas of Pictish settlement were in the modern Fife, Angus, Aberdeen and around Moray Firth, although later Gaelic migration may have erased some Pictish names from the record. Early Gaelic settlement appears to have been in the regions of the western mainland of Scotland, between Cowal and the adjacent islands, later expanding up the west coast in the 8th century. There is place name and archaeological evidence of Anglian settlement in the southeast of Scotland, reaching into West Lothian and to a lesser extent into the southern western of Scotland. Later Norse settlement was probably most extensive in Orkney and Shetland, with lighter settlement in the western islands, particularly the Hebrides and the mainland in Caithness, stretching along the fertile river valleys through Sutherland and into Ross. There was also extensive Viking settlement in Bernicia, the northern part of Northumbria, which stretched into modern borders and the lowlands. Okay, so the period saw dramatic changes in geography of the language itself as well. The divide between the Celtic languages into two major groups, the P-Celtic, from which Welsh, Breton and the Cornish derive from, and Q-Celtic, from which comes Irish, Manx and Gaelic. The Pictish language remains Ignatic, since the Picts had no written script of their own, and all that survives are place names and some isolated inscriptions in Irish script. Most modern linguists accept that, although the nature and unity of Pictish language is unclear, it is believed to the former group. Historical sources as well place some name evidence indicating the ways in which the Pictish language in the north and the Cumbric languages in the south were overlaid and replaced by Gaelic, English and later Norse in this period. So seeing a combined cultures of the languages between England and Scotland. The economy. I know, amazing subject. Like in the urban centres created under the Romans in the rest of Britain, the economy of Scotland in the early Middle Ages was overwhelmingly agricultural, so sheep, cows, etc. Without significant transport links and wider markets, most farms had to produce a self-sufficient diet of meat, dairy products and cereals, supplemented by hunter-gathering. Limited archaeological evidence indicates that throughout northern Britain, farming was based around a single homestead, or a small cluster of three or four homes, each probably containing a nuclear family, with relationships likely to become common among neighbours, houses and settlements, reflecting the partition of land through inheritance. Farming became based around a system that distinguished between the infield around the settlement, where crops were grown every year in outfield, and the outfield further away, where crops were grown and then left fallow in different years, in a system that would continue until the 18th century. The evidence of bones indicates the cattle were by far the most important domesticated animal, followed by pigs, sheep, goats, while domesticated fowl were rare. Imported goods found in archaeological sites of the period include glass, while many sites indicate iron and precious metal working as well. Alright, so now let's move on to the society. The prime unit of social organisation in Germanic and Celtic Europe was the kin group. The mention of descent through the female line in the ruling families of the Picts in later sources, and the resurgence of leaders clearly from outside of the Pictish society, has led to the conclusion that the system of descent was matrilineal. However, this has been challenged by a number of historians who argue that clear evidence of awareness of descent through the male line suggests that this is more likely to indicate a biliteral system of descent, where descent was counted through both male and female lines. A bit different back then. Scattered evidence, including the records in Irish annals and the images of warriors like those depicted in the Pictish slabs around the northern part of Britain, Anglo-Saxon Britain, on the other hand, was obviously very military, followed by kings and nobles whose status was dependent in large part on their ability and willingness to fight. Below the level of this area, it is assumed that there were non-noble freemen working their own small farms or holding lands as free tenants. There are no surviving law codes from Scotland in this period, but codes in Ireland and Wales indicate that freemen had the right to bear arms, represent themselves in law, and to receive compensation for murdered kings. Men. Indications are that society in North Britain contained relatively large numbers of slaves, often taken in wars and raids, or brought, as St. Patrick indicated the Picts were doing, from the Britons in southern Scotland. Slavery probably reached relatively far down in the society, with most rural households containing some slaves, because they were taken relatively young and were usually racially indistinguishable from their masters. Many slaves would have become integrated into their societies of capture, then the societies of origin, in terms of both culture and language. Living and working beside their owners, they in practice may have become members of the household without any inconvenience of the rights that they had. Where there is better evidence from England and elsewhere, it is very common for such slaves who survived to middle age to gain their freedom, with such freedom often remaining clients of their families or their former masters. Kingship. In the early medieval period, British kingship was not inherited in a direct line, as previously mentioned, from previous kings, as would be the case in the later Middle Ages. There were instead a number of candidates for kingship, who usually needed to be a member of a particular dynasty and to claim descent from a particular ancestor. Kingship could be multi-layered and very fluid. The Pictish kings were probably acting as overlords of other Pictish kings for much of this period, and occasionally were able to assert an overlordship over the non-Pictish kings, but occasionally themselves had to acknowledge the overlordships of external rulers, both Anglian and British, such as the Kingdom of Northumbria. Such relationships may have placed obligations to pay tribute or to supply armed forces. After a victory, sub-kings may have received rewards in return for this service. Interaction with and intermarriage into ruling families of subject kingdoms may have opened the way to absorption of such sub-kingdoms, and although there might have been later overturnings of these mergers, it is likely that a complex process by which kingship was gradually monopolised by a handful of the most powerful dynasties was taking place. The primary role of a king, like any king in history, was to act as a war leader, reflecting a very small number of minority or female reigning monarchs in this period. Kings organised the defence of their people's lands, properties and persons, and negotiated with other kings to secure these things. If they failed to do so, the settlements may be raided, destroyed or annexed, and populations killed or taken into slavery. Kings also engaged in the low-level warfare of raiding and more ambitious full-scale warfare that led to conflicts of large armies and alliances, and which could be undertaken over relatively large distances, such as the expedition into Orkney by Delrita in 581 AD, or the Northumbria attack on Ireland in 684 AD. Kingship had its ritual aspects. The kings of Delrita were augmented by putting their foot in a footprint carved in stone, signifying that they would follow the footsteps of their predecessors, follow their line. The kingship of the United Kingdom of Alba had scone and its sacred stone at the heart of its coronation ceremony, which historians presume was inherited from the Pictish practices. Anna, the early centre of Scottish Christianity, became the burial site of the early kings of Scotland until the 11th century, when the House of Canmore adopted Dunfermline closer to Scotland. Alright, moving to warfare, the battle scene from the Albano picture stone generally presumed to show the battle in 685 AD. At the most basic level, a king's power rested on the existence of his bodyguard or war band. In British language, this was called tellu. In later Latin word, it was called comitas or tutorus or even familia. Alright, the war band functioned as an extension of the ruler's legal person and was the core of the large armies that were mobilised from time to time for campaigns of significant size. In peacetime, the war band's activity was centred on the Great Hall. Here, in both Germanic and Celtic cultures, the feasting, drinking and other forms of male bonding that kept up the war band's integrity would take place. In epic poem in Beowulf, the war band was said to have slept in the Great Wall after the Lord had retired to his adjacent chamber. It is not likely that any war band in this period exceeded 120 to 150 men, as no hall structure having the capacity larger than this has been found by archaeologists in northern Britain. Picture stones show mounted and foot warriors with swords, spears, bows and helmets and shields. The large number of hill forts in Scotland may have made open battle less important than in Anglo-Saxon England, and the relatively high proportion of kings who are recorded as dying in fires or drowning suggests the siege were more important as a part of warfare in northern Britain. That's a good way to go out, getting drowned or dying in a fire as a king. Sea power may have also been important. Irish Annals records an attack by the Pictish on the islands of Orkney in 682 AD, which must have required a large naval force. They also lost 150 ships in a disaster in 729 AD. Ships were also vital in the amphibious warfare in the Highlands and the Islands from the 7th century. And Delvita had a ship muster system that obliged groups of households to produce a total number of 177 ships and 2,478 men. The same source mentions the first recorded naval battle around the British Isles in 719 AD and 8 naval expeditions between 56 AD and 733 AD. The only vessels to survive from this period are the dugout canoes, but images from this period suggest that there may have been skin boats similar to the Irish carrack and larger oared vessels. The Viking raids and invasions in the British Isles were based on superior sea power. The key to their success was a graceful, long, narrow, light wooden boat with a shallow draft hull designed for speed. The vessel that we all know and love. The shallow draft allowed navigation in waters of up to 3 feet, 1 meter deep, and permitted beach landers, whilst its light enabled it to be carried over long areas of land. Longships were double-ended, the symmetrical bow and stern allowing the ship to reverse direction quickly without having to turn round. And this is obviously the later design a lot of the Scottish kings would try enact before you start getting to the brigs of the Middle Ages. I think coming towards the end of this episode, we've learned around Scotland is still fractured with 4 major tribes leading the area, with the Pictish tribe being the strongest. Anglo-Saxon influence in the area was strong, especially from the Kingdom of Northumbria and even in Cumbria as well. Next episode, we're going to be touching on the Viking era, the start of the Viking era, the Viking impact on Scotland, along with the Saxon impact on Scotland, because we have the Viking impact to the west of Scotland, and obviously the islands of Strathclyde that were later taken over by the Vikings, and they impacted and influenced the Scottish society and culture a lot, as well as the Saxons, since the Saxon kingdom of Northumbria held control of the Pictish king for quite a lot of time. And to be fair, once the Kingdom of Alba would be formed, it would take some time before what we now know as Scotland would eventually be conquered. So we're talking Western Scotland and those islands. So that's what we're going to probably touch on in the next episode. Hope this episode has been very informative, trying to give you an idea of where we're at. We've left Roman Britain, we've left all that behind, we've learnt about that, and now we're going into Saxon Viking Britain. And I think it's good to have episodes like this to understand, the history, the layout, the geography, the demographics, etc. So we know, cracking on from next episode, what's going on between the Pictish king and the Saxon king, and why it's like that, and where the Saxons came from, etc. Anyway, thank you all for listening to today's podcast. Again, as always, the podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Although, to be fair, I'm most likely going to be taking it off SoundCloud, since it doesn't get many, many downloads. Talking about downloads, we are hitting hundreds of downloads per podcast. I did not suspect this much popularity when I first started these podcasts, and literally getting hundreds of downloads per podcast, even 200 on some comments, these new follows. It's great, guys. Really great to see you are enjoying this and everyone's enjoying this journey. I really look forward to doing the next episode, and as we go along in history, these episodes will be a lot more in detail and a lot more personal stories will be told, because the sources will be a lot more less vague, because at the moment we're getting vague overviews. But thank you anyway, thank you all for listening. If you're in the UK right now, the pubs are going to be opening soon, so go out, enjoy some time after this coronavirus crap, and I shall see you all next week. ready for a brand new episode. I think I'll try and release it a little bit earlier for Tuesday to make up for the lateness of this podcast. All right, guys, have a good one. Stay safe, and I will see you next time. Bye-bye.